The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
When I began to contemplate what would be the introduction to a retreat, a spiritual retreat, and quite frankly, although I hope you really need this retreat, I really need this retreat. And I love to do things that I also need, so this is like a fair trade-off. And so I was thinking, well, what would be the topic? And the topic I'd like to share with you is one of the keys of what they call good speaking habits, is you talk about something that really interests you, something that's really on your mind, something you're really dealing with. And so what I want to share with you is true confessions of a frustrated rabbi, okay? And why I need this retreat and what I hope to achieve at this retreat, and maybe just a little bit about the advantages of a retreat, the disadvantages of the retreat, and some ideas of how can we take this retreat and truly turn it into a treat, okay? So I want to tell you a story about the frog and the centipede. Once upon a time, there was a frog, and this frog constantly was pursuing and harassing the centipede. And the centipede, you might know, is this little creature that has all these little legs, right? And he would always try to catch the centipede, but he could never quite catch the centipede because the centipede has all these legs and he's very quick. Finally, the frog, out of total frustration, gave up. And he came up with an idea. So one day, hopping down the street, he sees his arch enemy, centipede, and now he's got a different strategy. He calls out to the centipede. Now the centipede sees him and he begins to set off. But the frog calls out, wait, one second. Hold it there. Forget it. I've been chasing you for months. I have never succeeded. So the race is over. The challenge is up. I give up. So we're finished, okay? Centipede was a little shocked by that. Thought, what is this, a trick? What's going on? Frog says, you know what? I do not want to pursue you. And you don't have to worry anymore. But I would like to ask you one last question now that the game is over. Please tell me, when you walk with all those little feet, which foot do you put first? Well, the centipede stopped dead in his tracks, turned back, said, interesting question. Never thought about it, right? Scratched his head, began to think about it, and could never walk again. And unfortunately, we won't tell you the end of the centipede. So, who is the frog in the story? Who is the centipede? Who is the centipede? The frog in this story is the intellect. The frog in the story is the philosopher, the observer, the one who analyzes, formulates, questions, challenges, try to figure things out. The centipede is the intuition. The centipede is the feeling. The centipede does what he does because this is what he does. He never really thought about it. He never really explored it. He never really articulated it. He knew how to walk because he knew how to walk with something simple, just as you know how to walk. He never really analyzed and thought about how is it when I walk? How is it when I lift my hand? What do I have to do to lift my hand? It's simple. So the frog in this story represents the intellect, the philosopher, the thinker, the observer, and the centipede represents the intuition, the feeling, the simple feeling, the participant. And so why do I sometimes feel very frustrated as a rabbi? Because as a rabbi, you find yourself being a frog most of the time, okay? Because what do rabbis do? They ask questions, and they start to talk, and they start to analyze, and they start to philosophize, and they start to encourage people to think about things and about themselves and about life that they're not used to perhaps thinking about. But the danger that the rabbi suffers is, A, Is he perhaps not complicating people's lives? Maybe it'd be better just let them be centipedes in their lives and just go with the flow and do as they feel and not ask these big ultimate questions and just kind of intuit and feel your way through life, right? And isn't it true that perhaps the rabbi himself, by virtue of talking so much about life and love and meaning and God, has essentially become completely frogged out? Right? Rabbi, it's all so much in your head. And we're able to so easily soar to great heights with our minds, even though our hearts and our emotions could still be in the dirt. Right. And a fragmentation is so easy to happen. So I have, quite frankly, quite honestly, a love-hate relationship with my job. Because my job is to talk about something that I don't like to talk about. In fact, talking about God and love and meaning and life is a very dangerous thing to be doing. Okay? There's a number of dangers when you talk about spirituality. And you get all into your head and you try to articulate that which is beyond all words, before all words. Right? One of the great problems of talking about this stuff is it makes you feel as if you're actually living this stuff, right? I mean, if we're talking about love and life and God and meaning, so obviously, if we understand it, obviously if we've succeeded in articulating it well, then obviously we're at that level. It's easy to confuse ourselves that just because I intellectually understand something, it's easy to think, now I am it. Now I live it. Now I feel it. Now I embrace it. But it's simply not true. It's very easy to be, you know, in your head and talk all about this and not live any of it. And it's an interesting thing because I've heard people complain that they met a religious Jew, right? And they even were a person who seemed to have a lot of knowledge in Judaism. I met even some rabbis, and they're not nice people. They're not sensitive. They're not compassionate. How's it possible that a person could study all this and still not be changed by what they study? And there's a story about a fellow who comes to his rabbi. He says, Rabbi, you know, I went through the entire Talmud. You know, the Talmud is thousands and thousands of pages. And the rabbi said, that's wonderful. You went through the entire Talmud, but how much of the Talmud has gone through you? Okay? It's very possible that you really confuse yourself and delude yourself to think that just because you're talking about this and you're able to talk about it on a very high level, you are it. There's a famous story about Bertrand Russell. Bertrand Russell was a great philosopher, wrote many, many books. He was a professor in ethics. And, well, one day, Bertrand was giving a lecture on ethics. Suddenly a woman in the hall, right, one of the students, stands up and says, I can't take it anymore. How could you be saying this stuff? How could you be teaching this stuff when you went to bed with me last night? Whoa, that was a real roar in the class. But then someone on the other side of the auditorium got up and said, oh, I don't believe it. I don't believe it. You said I was the only one. I can't believe it. You've been sleeping with this other woman? Right? And then another guy, no. And then another person on the other side got up and said, this is unbelievable. Well, what happened is that it turns out that Bertrand was having, you know, night classes, let's put it that way. Okay? He was tutoring people privately. And anyways, he got called in by the dean of the particular college that he was teaching at. And the dean challenged Bertrand, said, Bertrand, what's going on? You're our ethics professor. What is going on here? He said, listen, I don't understand your problem. Do you expect the math professor to be a math equation? No. Do you expect your biology professor to be biology specimen? No. Right? You see, that's the problem. You can evolve and you can intellectually articulate the most brilliant philosophical formulations of what life is all about, what love is all about, what meaning is all about, what God is about, and you remain a jerk, right? You are just a frog. And all that is in your head. And all that is very impressive. But you haven't merged with these ideas. You haven't really connected with these ideas. You haven't felt these ideas. You haven't become these ideas. It's really frustrating. especially when you succeed in articulating some very, very deep ideas, whereby your emotions, whereby your centipede, where that simple intuition that knew all this before you started to talk about this and figure this all out, has to catch up with your articulations. So I have a love-hate relationship with my job. Because on one hand, I'm causing wonderful, sweet centipedes to think about the simplest, most intuitive things that they should know already. You know what love is. You know what meaning is. You know God. You knew God before you said the word. You know love before you said the word. You knew meaning before you said the word. And now we're going to start saying words that could actually possibly complicate a true understanding of it, because we've substituted our deepest understanding with a bunch of words. It's a dangerous thing. It's a dangerous thing. My job is to talk about God. But the truth is, as I pointed out in my new book, the more you talk about God, the more you actually lose touch with whom it is that you're talking about. Right? And I'm constantly turning myself off to what I'm teaching. Right? Because what happens is what I know inside, what I experience, what I participate daily, when I have to talk about it and get out of it and look at it, then I kind of lose it. It's like meaning. If you sit down and start thinking about meaning, I would venture to guess that you would end up concluding life is meaningless. Right? From a philosophical point of view. But if you happen, as you're sitting in your state of contemplation, a philosophical, you know, analysis, you happen to see some old woman across the street, she needs help, you get up, you rush out, you help her with her bags, and all of a sudden you feel life is meaningful. Right? And so then you think about that. And then you realize it's not meaningful. Right? But then you see this little boy, and he's trying to get into the house, and he can't reach up for the doorbell. So you rush and you push the doorbell, right? Right? And then he turns and you say, "Now we run." Okay, just a little joke. Right? He was just playing Nicky Nicky Nand or whatever, the nine doors. But whatever, you all of a sudden feel meaningful. And you say, "Wow, that was a powerful experience." So you go back into your philosophical mode, and you think about that, but life is meaningless when you think about it. Because the life that you're thinking about is not life. In other words, we have this interesting kind of experience as human beings that in order to observe, to articulate, to philosophize, to conceptualize, you have to take three steps back out of life and look at it. But when you move yourself from life, you're not in life, it's not life anymore. You follow it. Okay? It's kind of like a person who wants to understand the beauty of a flowing river. So they catch it in a cup. Ah, this is it. It's not a flowing river anymore. Okay? And so what happens is that life and meaning and love can only be known through participation. But in order to understand it intellectually, you have to remove yourself from it. You have to pull yourself back. You have to observe it. But it's no longer the same thing. Right? Because it's not something you can observe. It's something you have to participate in. Okay? So talking about life and God and meaning and love, all that, is taking steps out of it all, observing, analyzing, thinking about it, rather than feeling it. Right? And you really run the danger of A, confusing yourself to think that now you know what you're thinking about, and now you understand it, so you must be living it. You run the danger of actually forgetting what it is that you were trying to understand. Why? Let me read you something from Kierkegaard. Kierkegaard, who was a philosopher, as you probably know, he wrote this: "Pure thinking is treason for the spirit. Any poet's existence is a sin, vis-a-vis the sin that one is writing poetry instead of living. That one occupies oneself with God and truth only in one's imagination instead of experiencing both existentially." See, when you talk about God, then you're talking about the God in your imagination, right? When you talk about love, you're talking about the love in your imagination, right? And the sin of the poet is that really he should be living his life rather than writing poetry about life. Because the life that you're writing about is not life. You can only be inside it to understand it. It's like, for instance, if you've ever seen Hasidim dancing, right? And so when they do this dance, religious do, they dance. What do they do? They dance in circles. And your head starts to spin a little bit because you watch these guys and say, "Where are they going?" And they do it for like hours. And you say, by now they must be tired of this, right? I mean, how many times can you end up the same place? If you watch it as an observer and analyze it and philosophize about it, you will never ever understand what they just did. The only way you'll understand is if you jump in and dance with them. It'll be even more interesting if you're a woman, right? Yeah, really interesting, right? But if you dance in and you dance, you discover that you are not actually dancing in circles. It's a spiral. And you never up in the same place, but you could never know that intellectually, you could never know that philosophically, conceptually. You could never know that as an observer. You would have to be a participant. And then after you went through that experience, you would take a couple steps back and try and understand that experience and articulate it, maybe explain it to your friend. But I always get this interesting idea where people say to me, you know, after Israelite, how do I tell my friends what it is that this was? And then when you go tell your friends what you experience, you look crazy. Right? They go, what are you talking about? What? You know, well, on Shabbos, we were closing our eyes and we were singing. Right. Right, that's good. I like that. Yeah, yeah. You're really getting healthier and healthier every day. You know, what number do I call to help you out? Anyways, it's, you know, when you're in your life experience, or when you're dating somebody, you try to explain to someone the love you're feeling for that person, right? And then you find out that as you talk about it more, it sounds even more and more ridiculous, harder to believe. You start to doubt whether this is love at all, right? Well, that's not love. That's just love talk. You need to be a participant in order to do that. So talking about these ultimate issues of love, life, God, spirit, all of it, stands the risk of A, substituting it with real knowledge, B, actually causing you to forget what it is that you were hoping to truly understand. Okay? There's another beautiful quote from a philosopher by the name of Andrik Bergson. Andrik Bergson says this. He was a Jewish fellow, but not a Jewish philosopher. And this is from his Introduction to Metaphysics. Analyzing consists of expressing a thing in terms of what it's not. Right? L-O-V-E is just a noise that we make that we've all decided is attributed to that experience which we can only know as participants. You follow that? Okay? Love. It's just noise. Okay? We've decided that that particular noise, other than the other noise, hate, which is just another noise, but we've all decided that the noise love is referring to some experience. But what happens is people talk so much about love, they get disconnected from what it is that we're talking, because they're so confused to think that because I know what L-O-V means and I look it up in the dictionary, now I know what it is. Okay? So Bertrand Russell says what happens is that you're expressing a thing in terms of what it's not. It's not words, it's not concepts. All analysis, therefore, is a translation, a development into a symbol. And therefore, the more I talk about something in terms of what it's not, the more I forget what it is. And this is a problem a rabbi has to do, because we have to talk about all these ultimate things all the time. And this is the danger that we risk, that instead of helping people, we possibly are confusing people, because we're actually giving them a bunch of noise and symbols and ideas which suggest what they should know and could know intellectually, experientially. But somehow all the talk is removing themselves from the actual experience. Okay? There's a fascinating piece in the Gemara. The Talmud says, and you're probably familiar with that, when you were in your mother's womb, you were taught the entirety of Torah, the wisdom of Judaism. But just as you are getting prepared to emerge into the world and to reveal to the world your incredible brilliance, right? An angel touches you here, and you come into the world with saliva rolling down your cheek. And it takes you the longest time just to say something of any meaning at all. Okay, so there's a number of understandings of that piece in the Talmud that essentially knowledge is something inner. We already know the truth. We're just trying to become aware of what it is that we already know. That really education is not a process of discovery. It's really a process of recovery. Okay. But one of the questions sages ask is this. But why is it that the angel touched us here? Why didn't the angel touch us here? If it's about forgetting, then the angel gives us a nice knock over the head, and that's it, right? We forget what it is that we're thinking. No, the angel touches us here. Why over our mouths? So one of the understandings is this is why we forgot. As soon as we came into the world and tried to explain, and articulate in words that which we knew before words, and that which we knew that is much greater than any words we could ever hope to express. As soon as we tried to talk about it, we forgot what it is that we were talking about. Okay? This, by the way, is one of the explanations of the first wrongdoing of Adam and Eve. They were not supposed to eat of the tree of knowledge of good and bad. And after they ate of the tree of knowledge of good and bad, there's a big drop. So some explain it like this. What? I mean, Adam and Eve didn't know good and bad. If they didn't know good and bad, how could they have a commandment not to eat from a tree of good and bad, right? I mean, you have to know that this was bad. Right? It doesn't make any sense. So the great Hasidic master of Simcha Bunim Pshusk, this is what he says. He said, Adam and Eve, they knew good, and they knew bad, but from inside. They couldn't quite ever explain to themselves or anybody else what's good, what's bad. It wasn't an intellectual thing at all. It was a deep intuition, a profound feeling of what is good and what is bad. But when they ate of the knowledge, the tree of knowledge of good and bad, now they want to understand what is good, and they want to understand what is bad, and they want to be able to articulate it intellectually, the difference between the good and the bad. And once you get into your head, it's easy to intellectually convince yourself that what you feel is good is actually bad, and what you feel is bad is actually good. We have this incredible ability to rationalize our way out of our hearts and lose touch with what we knew inside, get lost in our heads, and get removed and disconnected from our hearts. And that's it. Therefore, the Midrash says that God created Adam and Eve straight, right? We were originally very straight kind of people, yeshar, and we wanted complex accountings. What does that mean? It means that we were naturally in touch with love, life, meaning, God. We were fully involved with life, meaning, and God, which is the only way you can know all that. But what happened is that simple knowledge, which is intuitive and it's simple, because it's something you just know. Just like, imagine you brag about your ability to drink water. Did you see that? Yeah, I drink that. I mean, did anybody go to school to learn how to drink water? It's something natural, something simple. Now, when you intellectually analyze, it's not simple at all. If you went to a scientist and he began to explain to you, you know, the whole process of the brain and how the brain relates to the muscles and all that, if you were to take lessons in all that and truly understand scientifically the mechanics of it all, it might be a little more difficult all of a sudden. Like, oh my gosh, right? But it was simple. Adam and Eve were simple, not simplistic. The difficulty of our generation is that it's so difficult to be simple already. Right. We get so into our heads, do I love him, do I not love him, does she love me, do we love each other, do we understand what love is? In other words, there was a level where once upon a time, this was actually simple. We knew. Because we were involved. We were fully participating in life. But because we ate of the tree of knowledge of good and bad, we've now become lost in our articulations, lost in our philosophical, sophisticated understandings. But, well, am I therefore an anti-intellect? Well, is it terrible to be an intellect? If intellectualizing and observing and investigating takes me away from the simple knowledge which I should know inside, well, maybe we shouldn't do it. In other words, maybe we should not be frogs. Maybe we should be centipedes and live our lives naturally without ever thinking that big question, when I put my foot first, which one comes first? And then all of a sudden contemplate the rest of our lives and never get anywhere. So maybe we should be centipedes. No. You see, we are taught that Adam and Eve were actually going to eat of the tree of knowledge of good and bad. The mistake is that they ate it separate from the tree of life. If they would have eaten those two fruits as a salad, as a fruit cocktail, as a compote, right? Then that would have been fine. That would have been fine, right? If they would have gone to a juice bar and say, a little fruit of life and a little fruit of knowledge, please. And they just drink it, that would have been the secret of being a human being. Because it's clear that God really wanted them to eat of the tree of knowledge of good and bad. If I didn't want you to eat from that tree, would I put it in the center of garden? Would I then create a snake that goes around saying, eat it, eat it, eat it? I mean, obviously God wanted them to deal with this tree and have a desire for this tree. Why? Because the difference between a centipede and a human being is that we can be both participants and observers at the same time. Do you follow this? And this is the challenge of life. How to unite your intellect with your emotions? How to unite thinking about and feeling it? You see, when we think about, we're removed. We never say, I'm going to feel about it. I'm going to feel about this. Nobody feels about things. You feel it. In fact, interesting enough, why would feeling and emotion be the same word? Because emotions knows through merging, through connecting. You're literally feeling this. I have to feel this. Okay? And when it comes to feelings, it's immediate. You don't say, well, give me 10 minutes to feel this. You know? Feeling is immediate. Thinking, you can say, I need a day to think about this. Nobody ever says, I need a day to feel this. Right? I'll tell you, tomorrow I'll feel this. You know, the feeling is immediate. The feeling is direct. The feeling is emerging and involvement and immersion in life and love and meaning and God. But thinking about it is observing and removing. And if you separate these two, you are no longer human. You are no longer human. Why? You see, animals are complete participants in life. That's why, you know what's so nice about being in nature? There's a certain challenge in nature. Because you feel that the tree is the tree, is the tree. I never look at trees and get a feeling that it's got some kind of identity crisis, you know? I really should have been a flower in my life. I don't know how I got this way, you know? You don't feel that. Or in the mornings when I would dive in here and I'd watch the ducks. I have a certain envy for those ducks. Because they're not rabbis, right? Those ducks aren't frogs. They're ducks. What do? They just are. They're completely in their duckiness. Right? They're completely ducks. You don't intuit that these ducks, when they're with each other, they're having like, Sal, what'd you think about that fish we had yesterday? They forgot about that fish yesterday. They're not dealing with, where do you think tomorrow's fish will come from? They don't think about tomorrow. They don't think about yesterday. They are completely in the moment. They're completely involved. They've merged with this moment. And I have an envy for ducks, right? They're completely involved with life. But what do they not have? They don't have self-consciousness. In other words, because they can't get outside their moment and look at their moment, they don't know that they're having this moment. Listen to this, okay? In other words, you can see a dog happy. But does that dog know he's happy? In order to know you're happy, you have to kind of step out of your experience and say, oh, this is happiness, okay? But then, of course, it's no longer happiness. As soon as you say, oh, this is happening, you still feel depressed, right? Because you're no longer in the moment. But for you to know you're in the moment, you have to leave the moment, almost transcend it, remove yourself, and look at it. But then it's not it anymore. You're looking at it, but you're not in it. Do you follow this? That's what I said before. When you think about life and contemplate its meaning, you will intellectually contemplate yourself out of meaning. Because the meaning of life can only be known experientially, existentially, as a participant in life. But if you're always participating in life and meaning and love, how would you know this is love? How would you know this is really being alive? How would you know this is meaning? How would you know this is God? Unless you could kind of step back and look at it and observe it and say, what is this? But then you're not in it. Animals can't do this. Animals don't have the ability to do what we can do, which is be in and out of ourselves at the same time. To kind of see ourselves speaking, and yet also speaking. It's a strange thing. But that's what's unique about human beings. We can be observers, and yet participants. observers and yet participants. In order to become conscious of your experience, you have to become an observer. In order to have an experience, you have to become a participant. In other words, the goal of life is to become a frog and a centipede simultaneously. Right? But you can't do this, so we have to do it really fast. You have to be out of it and look at it and then go back into it and feel it. And then not be too long where you lose consciousness of what it is because you have no perspective, you can't take a look at it, so you have to go back out of it and then go back into it. Okay? This is the problem of being a rabbi, that very often we're observers. And our job sometimes is to get people into observing mode. Take a look at your life. Take a look at yourself. Take a look at your love. But of course, the flaw in that is then it's not love, then it's not life, then it's not me. So I have to go inside it. So don't forget to go back inside it. See, the Talmud says something very beautiful. The Talmud says a protection to wisdom so that you don't lose it and that it doesn't lose you is silence. Because everything we're trying to intellectually, rationally articulate, we knew before we said any words. And as the Talmud pointed out, as soon as we started to try and speak, we forgot what it is that we're speaking about because we left it by speaking about it. Right? It's like when you're in that magical moment of romance and you're looking into each other's eyes and all of a sudden you blurt out, "I love you." Sometimes you feel really stupid saying that. You almost feel like you destroyed the moment. Because just saying the word, you know, we all kind of walked out of the moment and looked at it. Oh yes, look at those two lovers. But we're no longer those two lovers because we're outside of it. And so the Talmud says, to protect your wisdom, you have to have time for silence. Now this is the advantage and disadvantage of a spiritual retreat. Because, and this is why we've created the retreat the way it is. There'll be times where we'll be sitting and thinking about being Jewish, about life, about love. And we'll be taking a few steps back and looking at things. We'll be taking a few miles back and looking at our life in New York City, or looking at our life in Los Angeles, or looking at, and we're removing ourselves to look at it. Remember, it's skewed because you're looking at something which you can only know by being in it, but it's important to look at it, to become conscious of it. And then there's times for this retreat to experience, to feel, take a walk into nature, right? Take a canoe ride into the middle of the lake, jump into the water and feel, you know, just chat and have a good time and play games. It always has to be a dance. A dance between being an observer and a participant. A dance between being intellectual and thinking about it and being emotional and feeling it. A dance between being out of it and looking at it and being in it and feeling it. And that's the dance of life. That's what a retreat can be. It's a chance to step back and look at your life. But it's also a chance to jump into life. It's a chance to think. It's a chance to feel. It's a chance to unite the frog and the centipede inside ourselves.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.